You are listening to a Campfire Firecast.
We're all falling and we need a place to hide. A safe place somewhere in the woods, we can start a fire.
Hi, this is your Firestarter Pete Lawrence, bringing you the fifth Campfire Convention Firecast. In this particular episode, we're talking about global beacons, and one in particular, New York, which has just been set up as a beacon by Mia San, who's a newcomer to Campfire Convention. She's also looking at setting up in Los Angeles, and talks to me about an assortment of things from diversity through to the political climate in the States and the importance of human touch.
My name is Me. That's my nickname, two E's. I was not born with that name. In fact, I wasn't born with any name, let's face it. So, you know, some people who would call my parents called me Izan. and I've had a few nicknames along the way, but Me is my current operating name. I am known as Izan Spevak.
Describe yourself in five words.
I'm creative. Undeniably creative, undeniably honest. I would say I'm multifaceted. I think other people would say complex. intelligent or intellectual, potentially. I don't really like the word intellectual, but I definitely like intelligent conversation and thinking about things. And the fifth word isn't a word. I guess it's work in progress or progress in English.
What are you up to?
My current focus is something I'm calling integrity. Integrity has a Y at both sides, as opposed to the regular word. And it is a word I'm using for the sensory experiences that I build. So they're immersive performances that engage all five of the primary senses, and sometimes more than the five primary senses, in a creative way, with a meaning at its heart.
How's the campfire for you?
It's great, yeah. I initially heard about it from Jonathan Goldsmith, who is a dear friend of us both. So yeah, he was very excited, and so I thought I'd check this thing out, and it looked very intriguing. And then I was so glad to, you know, be able to have time with you, Pete, to, you know, sort of tell me, give me the lowdown and the detail of it. And you know, as it's coming into focus, I'm sort of just really seeing, I think it could be it is already, but will grow to be an even more valuable resource for something that's just really essential to the human experience, you know, us as individuals connecting and finding meaning and community together is important and a little bit endangered in our more insular sort of times. So yeah, I think it's really good.
And who would you invite to your campfire?
Well, I am going to be inviting, three people came to mind today. My good friend Johns is being invited already, and Nick the Record, dear friend for 20 years, wonderful DJ, and for years he was half his time in London or Brighton actually, and half his time in Japan, where his child is as well, or one of his three children. So yeah, he came to mind because Japan, as much as Nick, you know, sorry, but that was the case. And then Steve Radford came to mind today because he's an old friend of us both, isn't he? He's from the band Knights of the Occasional Table from the 90s, and currently resident in Glastonbury. And it just seems that would be a nice way of tying in that town. And then actually I'm going to invite New York City and Los Angeles. That's like my main mission, to just try and increase the diversity of the community, and the perspectives that are available in different continents. You know, they just really are different cultures that can all obviously feed each other, and as well as, you know, just New York and Los Angeles themselves sort of getting the benefits of this medicine.
That's great, thank you. And we'll keep rolling. I mean, we're coming together to talk about, I suppose, global beacons as a focus, which the idea was floated a couple of weeks ago, really, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we've had a good feedback initially. It's looking like we're going to be able to do some things outside the UK. And one of the fantastic things about your ideas is to launch in New York and Los Angeles in a very quiet, very DIY fashion, I guess. Nobody knows what's going to happen, really, with Campfire. It's a bit of a social experiment. So what was your inspiration for saying yes to get stuck into doing that, really?
Well, I suppose as somebody who has been a newcomer to a major city more often than most, you know, I arrived in Los Angeles. I knew one person who lived there, and he was not home. So I knew no one when I moved to LA. Actually, no one there. Right. And I remember that first week, you know, sort of being slightly terrified and thinking, well, I've just got to go out. So I went out to a club and met three people. One, and it was right near Christmas, and one of them said, well, come over for Christmas. It was so special and random. And then all his friends came, and suddenly, you know, 3 years later, I know a lot of people and really nice ones, and it grew. But I have that strong memory of how isolated that first 3 years was uphill. You know, the first week was terrifying, but then, it takes a while to really build roots and build trusted, strong, deep relationships. And then I did it again when I moved to New York. you know, and I think actually there is a difference between being new in town when you're in your 20s, like if you go to university or something, or in your 30s, like I was when I arrived in LA, or I think I was 41 when I moved to New York. And each time it's different. The opportunities to meet people decrease. And so I guess that was also the for me, there was this kind of like moment when I saw, you know, John said, go have a look. And I saw community. And I know your work specifically, Pete. You know, I know that you all have always consistently, you know, built communities that are interesting, kind, like-minded people that are open-minded and, you know, in some way, you know, very diverse actually as well. It's not sort of one type, but it's sort of a space that's welcoming for anyone who's like, you know, decent. And so I thought there was, you know, good potential for me as somebody who's newly returned to this country to integrate that. And also I'm very keen to, you know, continue my and build on even deepen my friendships in New York and Los Angeles specifically, because I really care about those two towns. They've really been very kind to me and I love them, and yeah, just sort of do that connecting thing.
It's interesting you talk about opportunities decreasing when you get older, but would you say with that comes a different perspective? Perhaps the quality of those opportunities or the quality of those relationships perhaps becomes a bit richer.
Yes, for those that do have the time, it's based really on time and availability mostly. I think that, you know, in your 20s, you've got plenty of time and availability. You haven't really built your friendship network yet. But when you're 40, you've spent the last 20 years knowing someone, and you've got your primary, you've got best mate and probably your partner, and, you know, you've got kids now and you've got a job, and like, you really haven't got that much time and no really a need to add a new, like, really good friend. So that's where it's sort of... But then, yeah, you do find those people who really, they have a curiosity and a vacancy for someone. And, you know, I have in New York, I've built some extraordinary relationships there, who are some of the people that I'm hoping to sort of link up with Campfire, because I think they're also, you know, people with curious minds who would be into, just exploring that.
And perhaps there's a sense that in your 20s and certainly teens, it's much more geared towards hedonism. So there's less chance of sitting down and having the sort of quality conversations you might have when you're a bit more sedentary.
I don't know. Actually, I'm going to challenge that. I'm really not sure about that. No, I think that there's an enormous amount of navel gazing and reflection historically and traditionally, actually, if any demographic is on that, it's people who are trying to form their initial beliefs. I think a lot of people, older people, are just sort of like running on automatic. They did the work in their teens probably, and they're just sort of like still got the same belief patterns and are sort of rolling with unexamined assumptions from a long time ago. So I do think that people in millennials, if I may, I hate that fucking term, actually, why should I even say that, but like people in their 20s and early 30s are questioning everything in a way that I think maybe a previous generation did less of.
But perhaps a lack of the confidence they might gain later, or do you think confidence isn't necessarily age-related? I'm thinking back to particular people within Campfire who've said, thanks for giving me that push into hosting a panel or coming up with an article or whatever, which I wouldn't have had, but you pushed me out of my comfort zone and now I feel stronger as a result of doing that.
I think perhaps it's actually just maturity and experience and length of time on the planet. If you're younger, you've had less exposure to a whole range of ideas, probably, because simply the length of time that you've had. Whereas if you have had an inquiring mind and you've had longer on the planet, you've probably just collected more data, if I will, from reading books or speaking to other people or whatever it is. So in that way, older people have the potential to have a deeper conversation. But that is just a potential. I don't think it's necessarily realised. And likewise, younger people, it's not necessarily that they have a more curious mind. So all of these sort of observations, actually, I'm just going to sort of, mitigate with that thing of it really is a personality type plus the number of years on the planet, or the amount of time you have in the day currently to reflect.
And the sense that there are health benefits attached to community as well. I mean, George Monbiot wrote an article in The Guardian that got shared widely last week about... he based it on Froome. I don't know if you saw that article, but it was about the health benefits of being part of a community. And
yes, we briefly touched on that when you were in London. And my sort of added insight to that was, what I was saying about the difference between the genders. So basically, the difference between the male brain and the female brain, according to neuroscientists, is zero. There is a completely zero difference. If you extract surgically a male brain and a female brain, there's no difference in weight or size or anything, it's sort of in relative bodies. The difference in hormonal makeup of men and women is quite marked. And the way that the brain reacts to those differences in hormonal makeups is also... they're present in some areas, not many, but in some. And one of the areas that it is medically present is when cortisol levels are raised. So when cortisol levels, the fight or flight thing, the adrenaline causing hormone, is raised, for example, when people have an argument, the way that a body that has more testosterone lowers the cortisol level, which is important for heart health and various things. The way that a body with more testosterone would lower a cortisol rate is by spending time alone. So it's watching TV, playing games, going to the man cave. That would be a medical way of lowering cortisol, which is a very important thing to do. For a body that has more estrogen, higher estrogen levels in it, the way to lower cortisol is connect together with another human and chat, and in no way necessarily related to the problem at hand that caused the cortisol whatsoever. It could be chat about anything, chat about science, car mechanics, cookery, whatever you want. But it is the human connection, it's that community thing. It's just having another mammal of the same species and having that feeling of connection for people with more estrogen lowers it. So for, women, that would be have a chat on the phone works, or in person works even better. And this is according to, medical science. So I just thought it was kind of interesting, that thing of, you know, and that's how it often seems to work in a practical way. Just like, if there is a problem that arises from a man and a woman, often the gentleman seems to want to go to the man cave and the lady wants to connect and talk about it. And I think that kind of knowledge of you know, the real differences between men and women in a physical way, actually, I think is really important information for like, and it makes everyone feel better. You know, like, I think, you know, women knowing that will be like, oh great, he's off to lower his cortisol, that makes sense. And for the men, they'll be like, oh shit, she only wants to talk now and talk it through when I just want to fucking go to the man cave, because she's lowering her cortisol rate. Yeah, I mean, it might also, I don't know if there's a demographic difference in terms of the age range, because obviously these hormonal differences are you know, lessen. I don't know if that's in there or not, it's just a thought, but I do know that for, you know, of course, men and women both have these hormones that we're talking about. I was talking about a heightened moment of like a cortisol release, but community is something, we are tribal mammals, you know, so whatever your gender, it's essential for human health and longevity and protection against, you know, all the major illnesses. It's like so much data around that, like we need each other. So yeah, that's completely built in.
So New York and LA, are you picking up on a sense that people really need to talk at the moment with the current political climate in America? How does that compare to how you see Britain? You've just come back into Britain after an absence of some time. How are you seeing it, and how do the two compare?
Gosh, let's see. I mean, it's so subjective, isn't it? My experience is so subjective, but I suppose there is something there in that, you know, it's still me. My friends, my demographic of friends are, you know, roughly comparable in these different cities, we just thought. They're all sort of like interesting, curious people. Let's see. Well, in New York specifically, that seems to be the epicenter in my experience, talking very broadly. I'd say Brooklyn specifically is the epicenter of identity politics. And so everybody pretty much has an awareness around identity politics, around men and women, and around queer culture and colour. And, you know, poverty or wealth and religion, how all of those things play out in society and have historically, and how we want to see it going forward. And the need for diversity is something that's just completely built in. And I suppose that was something when I came to London. Like, there's not a panel in New York City in any industry where they are not aware that they have to have a bit of diversity on that panel, where if they don't actively seek diversity, without a doubt, it's just going to be white men on that panel, because historically in every industry, the people who've had access to the information that is of use to everyone would be white men on that panel. So there's a big effort being made, because not because they're just sort of being right on, but because there's an understanding that for every industry, we need diversity. There's not a, you know, you can't sell sneakers if every person at the ad company is a white man. You're just not going to hear, you know, Latino women if you're selling sneakers, unless you, so in every industry you have that same thing. You just have to have diversity. And so it was shocking to me when I came here and I went, the first panel I saw was at the St. Martin's School of Art, the progressive bastion of, you know, just like, and it was all white men. And I was like, oh my God, like, that's incredible. That obviously isn't a thing here, that conversation. And I was aware that that would be seen here as a very challenging sort of like man-hating sort of like stance, where, as opposed to what that actually is, which is really the opposite of a man-hating stance. It's how the reality of how society works and how men actually in the room, if anyone's going to learn something from a panel, actually the white male delegates who have come to learn something are much more likely to hear. If they've got some, you know, person of colour who is female, potentially differently abled, on the panel saying something from their experience, there's no one in the room that's going to learn more than a white man from that perspective. And if we're all there to learn something, like, you know what I mean? Really, it's just like diversity is key.
And hearing other people's stories. I mean, how can Campfire be more diverse?
I don't know. Well, I guess actually I do know. It's doing those sort of positive choices in leadership roles. As soon as you put somebody in a leadership role that is in some way diverse, that creates an immediate psychology where other people will step forward and feel safe to say something. So there is something around that, and I know that's organically happening. But yeah, just to be clear again, just so you know, I do want to sort of stress that diversity includes white men. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, all of the genders and all of the races, including that. But it's just, yeah, that thing of like, we all have something really special to offer.
So in terms of beacons and what they can do, what are you picking up on from what you've heard about the beacons so far that you think is we should be focusing on? What's important about the calls to action we're beginning to formulate? In many ways, we're making it up as we go along, and that's the whole nature of Campfire, really. It's a social experiment. We don't know where it's going to lead. But certainly with the beacons, there's a sense that, for instance, with the Brighton Beacon, they developed the Firegram, which was a way of focusing on outcomes from the meetings. With Bournemouth, just in one meeting, their calls to action resulted in them getting involved with the homeless initiative straight away and looking at plans for an organic farm and a food cooperative and possibly their own mini festival. So just from two beacons, and Malvern also have had several meetings, they're developing as one of the first beacons. It's interesting to see already the sort of templates that are being set up that people can perhaps use for reference.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're all really extraordinary. I guess the thing that you sort of mentioned earlier that did resonate was, you know, because I've got this this understanding of how science and art meet and the senses and the role that sort of experiential sensory theatre has to play in general. And the fact that Campfire Convention does have this unusual, potentially unique, I think, sort of thing of being an online community and an offline community. That's sort of really the USP, I think, of from what I can see. So the sensory element is potentially could be built in. And so I think that the Firegram, it's really fun. And it's really, really, I think, completely useful for an urban environment like New York, where we, you know, it's gonna be hard to have an actual fire, but a Firegram, totally. And it builds into even the cultural irony. There's the kind of irony thing in Brooklyn. They're going to love that, you know. But also to sort of, you know, build in some kind of sensory thing. So human touch is the element that is lacking from every online social media platform. And so that's the thing that sort of I want to in some way offer. I haven't quite figured out yet how. I mentioned not a secret handshake, not a rolled up trouser leg like the Masons. You know, we're not that. We're not a secret society, but we are a community. And so to have some kind of element where it's sort of fire-based, beacon-based, but it involves human touch and, something around that.
Because I watched your TED talk and that was essentially about sensory experience.
Yeah, that's my sort of area for the last sort of 4 years I've been developing, 3-4 years. Something.
And the thing that really stuck in my mind and really resonated was where you asked everyone to hold hands to actually that sense of human touch was just very resonant.
Thank you.
Even watching the video, I imagine if you were doing it there, it would have been really powerful.
It was. There were 1,200 people at the talk, and it's in Bend, Oregon, which is Oregon is like a really specific state. The Bend, Oregon, it's white rural America, So there were a lot of, probably 50% Trump supporters, I'd say, there, you know, sort of like, you know, white working class Americans, men who go hunting and fishing, quite a few vets, also quite a few elderly people. It's a retirement place these days. So you've got this, like, the original layer of people, which are kind of the more, you know, hunting and fishing people. And then you've got the new ones who are kind of wealthy, kind of Aspen people. And so that's who the audience was, 1,200 of them there. I remember that I think the one that really captured it, the one where I was just like, oh, that was worth doing, actually, was after the fact, you know, how the TED format is, that then people go away and have little basically focus groups after the talks and talk about their insights and what happened, and we as speakers can go around and have a little kind of fly on the wall, listen and hear the feedback. And so I went into one of the little classrooms and heard what was going on, and there was a man there who was a vet, rugged, sort of, I guess probably late 20s, early 30s guy, and he said he was sat in between his girlfriend and his mum. So when they all held hands, he said all three of them were crying. And, you know, just from the touch of being there together, because, like, he's a bloke, you know, like, he's a hunting fishing bloke. He's probably not done that. You know, he's probably held hands with his girlfriend, and he's definitely held hands with his mum at some point. But, like, for them, the three of them to be linked in that chain, in that space, in the dark, with them all having the also the taste and the smell and the, you know, the talk all about the environment. And as hunting and fishing people, by the way, even though you might not think that Trump supporting type of people give a fuck, but actually hunting and fishing people have a, even if they don't believe in climate change and the science that I believe in, they do have an interaction with nature that's incredibly intimate. So yeah, me going on about the oceans being in trouble and them holding hands in the dark and being like, yeah, the oceans, yeah, I know about fish, there's less, you know. So yeah, he had quite a emotional moment, which was what I do. It's what I do. Yeah.
So going back to the role of the beacons, and we're sitting here in Froome, hotbed of new and radical ideas, progressive politics, independence. There's a sense that campfires coming in here, we're putting on a meeting in a few weeks. What do? We don't want to tread on toes. There are lots of activist groups, you know, whether you like the word activist or not, people being active. I see a potential role for campfire as almost collecting resources and giving signposts to these are the interesting people, perhaps trying to physically link some of them up, mm-hmm. connecting the map.
Yeah.
Without saying we're going to be an umbrella for the whole thing, because that would be quite presumptuous, I think. So how would you see campfire's potential role in big American cities? Would it be on a similar level to Froome, or is it a different dynamic?
I mean, I guess what I said earlier is that I think, because Froome is a real community, and it really is a the right sized umbrella. I was seeing, you know, there's New York City, but it's massive. Like, then, and it's not real in the same way that many cities aren't, you know, cohesive communities, right? So you know, there's different zones of lots of most big places. So you know, I live in the Lower East Side. It's a particular demographic there. It is. It's always been. I mean, the original building, the building I live in, is a tenement building. It's a very special history. It's where Europeans like me came, different waves of them. And it's where immigrants come. It's the root of the American dream, actually. The 19th century immigration from Europe, people wanting more freedom, wanting more religious freedom, specifically a lot of them, political freedom. It's a hotbed of radical ideas and, yeah, it's like what we do in the Lower East Side. The Upper East Side is the bastions of culture. It's like, you know, where, you know, it's a very conservative place. Midtown is where Mr. Trump lives, or lived, sort of still is based, really. So that's, you know, what they do there in general. I think all of his friends and neighbours pretty much do something like that there. The Upper West Side is where you've got your sort of intellectuals historically, your sort of like, you know, psychotherapists and authors are sort of up there. You've got the East Village, which is sort of, now it's like Patti Smith, basically. It's sort of an older community that's still intact, of radicals from a while ago who are still elderly people who are amazing. You know, the sort of Bowie, Patti Smith sort of generation, who've been friends with each other for years and are still really radical. Then you've got the West Village, and that's media, lots of gay people there. You've got Chinatown, Chinese people, actually mostly multi-generation. They actually arrived in around 1880, most of them. So they speak Chinese still, a lot of them don't speak English, but actually have been there for sort of maybe four or five generations. There's a different bit, Tribeca. These are all different communities. So, and I think the same could be said probably for any metropolis where you've got, like, you know, pretty strong histories and current communities. I have put a pin in New York City because, hey, someone had to do it. But then I'm also going to put a pin in for Lower East Side, because that is my micro community, and that's sort of what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think it's worth stressing that in London, I think there's a London beacon, but there's plenty of potential for people to set up particular areas, Finsbury Park beacon or Brixton or Camden or whatever.
So, totally, because they're all little villages. Mm. I'm quite partial to Camden at the moment. I think it's such a rich history. I think, you know what, Camden, it seems to me that it was the beginning of alternative counterculture ideas. It was the beginning for pretty much everyone. Like, people who are newly arrived, you know, Polish people or Spanish people who haven't been in the country very long, pretty much started their journey in Camden, because it's a touristy sort of place, right? So everyone sort of like hits it. You know, people who are born in London had their awakening in Camden, whatever their age group, pretty much. It's like, it's consistent. Like, Camden really does deliver, and it still delivers. It's a bit touristy, but it's still there. I'm quite partial to that at the moment. It's my current favourite spot, but yeah, it moves around.
So what's next up for you? You're obviously looking at late spring for potentially getting these beacons moving before summer solstice.
I think that's a rough timeline. I'm going to be travelling a lot this year, primarily between New York and London. There will be also Los Angeles in late June, early July. My hope is that I'm going to be able to do something in New York and in Los Angeles around the solstice. We'll see if that actually happens. My birthday happens to be June 24th. So I'm thinking that means I'll do solstice in New York City and then get on an aeroplane and be in LA for my birthday, which would be then also a good opportunity to do a beacon there. So we'll see if that happens. But that's my current aim. I think that would be really fun to sort of, you know, gather those two communities and just sort of plant a little pin and give that beacon, that torch, to someone else who's a little more stably local.
Yeah, I think passing on the torch is very much ingrained in the whole campfire ethos. So yeah. I can see already that's your thinking.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Well, we'll watch with interest, and very exciting.
Thank you. Well, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to, carry your torch across to the Atlantic to the colonies. Did I say that?
Been listening to a Campfire Firecast.